golfers are becoming more optimized in terms of maximizing strokes gained. That's why we see golfers, hitting certain clubs off of tees. Why are more people going for, the green at Riviera? Why are more people, less people laying up? So the driving distances in those holes has gotten huge. If you like looked at it over time, if you're just looking at the data and you go, wow, look at how much the driving distance on this drivable par four has increased. That's not a function of people getting faster. That's a function of strategy. People realizing that this is the best way to maximize strokes gained.
Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne. Thanks so much for joining us. And if you're watching this on YouTube, you'll note a different location this week. I'm on the road at the Golf Course Superintendents Association Conference in Phoenix, thus the sunburn and the hotel room behind me. I arrived here straight from Orlando and the PGA show where the Titleist booth, or it's sort of the Titleist campus there, it was anchoring the show with a lot of must-see new products, including a new lineup of Phantom putters from Scotty Cameron, but also the new SM10 wedges from Bob Vokey. Titleist new Vokey design SM10 wedges are engineered to produce a lower, more controlled flight with improved feel and maximum spin, advancing the performance of the game's most played wedges through an unrelenting focus on master craftsman Bob Vokey's keys to great wedge play. There are 6 sole grinds to choose from and 3 finishes to pick from. So go to Titleist.com where you can use the wedge selector tool there and find the right grind and setup for you today. Very excited to welcome Sasha McKenzie to the podcast. Fans of Chasing Scratch will know Sasha's name as a coach that's helped them in their pursuit of more speed. And if you watch the U.S. Open at Brookline, you'll recall all the talk about Matt Fitzgerald's speed gains thanks to Sasha McKenzie and his stack system. Sasha is a professor of sports biomechanics at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia, a biomechanics advisor and software developer at FootJoy, but probably most well known as the co-founder of the Stack system used by everyone from AMs to major winners. So in this discussion recorded live in the Broken Tee Society Discord server, we talk about speed and ways to get the most out of your swing, but we talk about a lot of other things as well, including fitness and playing with injury or playing through injury, as well as Sasha's journey from working in other sports to becoming one of the most sought-after consultants in golf. And we, of course, talk about what it was like to watch one of his pupils win a U.S. Open. And a special deal coming with this podcast. Exciting news. Since we're speaking with the founder of the Stack system, we're offering 20% off the Stack system for all Golfers Journal members. The discount code is waiting for you in your member locker. So just log into your Golfers Journal account, go to your locker, and start hitting it farther. I'm a Stack system user. Can't recommend it highly enough. It is fun to use. It's an easy to use app. You see your progress. You see your distance potential. It really works. I'm not sure how it works. Actually, though, I think I understand it better now after talking with Sasha and having this discussion about all the science that's gone into the workout. So get yours today at 20% off. Of course, you have to be a member to get the discount. So if you aren't a member, please do sign up. We are always working here to bring more value to your membership. And as always, we cannot thank our members enough for their support. So without further ado, quiet please. Now on the Golfers Journal podcast, Sasha McKenzie. Sasha, you're doing a lot. Professor, FootJoy advisor, biomechanist, the Stack system. What's a day in your life look like?
Yeah, well, right now over the winter, I teach a couple of classes. I teach an introductory biomechanics class and an advanced biomechanics class in my lab here. I've got everything kind of aligned, in, at least in golf. You know, so most of my examples in my intro class are about golf. My advanced class is all about golf and applying biomechanical principles to that. But lots of conversations with tour coaches. At least speak to someone like Mark Blackburn or Chris Como every day. Working with a few players, so I'll have a few conversations with someone like a Matt Fitzpatrick. Usually around a stack training. I've got a project I'm doing right now with Ping. I don't know if you can kind of see putter of my head where we're looking at trying to test different putter weightings and how they influence the stroke. I usually have some FootJoy shoes kicking around. You can see some in the background. So I've got a project going on with FootJoy. This afternoon, I'm collecting some data for Rapsodo. Heading to the PGA show. So getting lots of messages going on with that, setting up the stack booth. So there's my dates are pretty varied. Coach hockey. I also have three kids, so spend a lot of time in the
rink. Hockey.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So yeah, it's good. It's good.
Is there a stack system for?
There isn't. I'd love to get into the theories, but hockey slap shot is very, very different from a golf swing. Golf swing, you can completely let go of the club at impact and it will have no influence on ball speed. Hockey, you can't let go of the stick at impact. You need to be applying maximum force when the stick hits the ice to store energy in the shaft, and then that gets deflected into the puck. So completely different physical principles at play between maximizing puck velocity and ball velocity in golf.
Okay. So biomechanics.
There is a stack system for baseball.
That's right. Okay. Biomechanics. I think people, you hear it and you have an idea of what that means. But can you give us sort of a baseline definition when we're talking about biomechanics and what we're looking at?
Yeah, sure. Biomechanics is rooted in physics, mechanical physics. It's like engineering. So it's effectively Newton's laws, F equals MA, torque equals I alpha. Those are the basic fundamental principles. But instead of applying it to machines or robots, we apply it to humans. And there are specific ways that humans generate force with their muscles. So we need to, broaden our understanding of those physical principles to include some biological concepts as well. And if we're looking at sport performance, then you want to take those principles and apply them to figure out the best way to move. What's the best way to generate speed, given the properties of the human body and understanding the physiological principles? Is there a way that's better to move a golf club for repeatability? Is there a better way to design a golf club to interact with that human when they're applying muscular forces?
Okay. So, I mean, what got you interested in working in that field?
Definitely a big sports fan growing up. I really, participated in a lot of sports. I played volleyball and did track and field at university, but also have a real passion for math and engineering. And it seemed like a great way to marry the two. You know, it wasn't like a focused effort going through my undergrad. It was like, hey, I like kinesiology like stuff, but I also like taking engineering, computer science, math, and really like golf. And boy, this seems like a great way to mix everything together. 20 years ago when I was kind of doing my PhD and customizing shaft stiffness to a person's swing, you could see a big difference between golf science and, say, track and field science. And track and field was much further ahead. There was a few little pockets in golf science that were trying to make headway, things like Search for the Perfect Swing, World Scientific Congress of Golf. But for the most part, it was a lot of misinformation. Generally out there, things weren't very strong from a scientific standpoint. If you talk to somebody, hey, give me a good golf science book, they'd give you the Golfing Machine. Someone said, hey, you should read this during your PhD thesis. So it seemed like there was a lot of opportunity to apply math and physics and science and principles of kinesiology into golf.
So when you're looking, and you mentioned hockey, baseball. So in terms of the movements necessary in golf, what sports are similar? How do one sport to the next, which is closest to golf? And How are the muscles you're using in golf different from other sports?
Yeah, so I think it depends on the specific skill you're looking at. So if you're looking at driving a golf ball, hitting a baseball is, you know, very, very similar in terms of you have an implement, you know, ballpark relative to all other implements. A baseball bat is similar-ish to a golf club. You know, it's heavier, it's shorter, but it's closer than a tennis racket. It's probably a little bit closer that, you know, than a lot of other implements. But then you'd say, okay, well, what are some differences that we expect to see? Well, you know, a golf club swung at a plane that's at about 45 degrees, give or take a little bit. Baseball's much flatter. So if we're looking at, if I'm, you know, I do some consulting in the baseball space as well. I've had some phone calls with the, a lot of work with the Dodgers, work with the Red Sox, with hitting. And, you know, from a, say, a ground reaction force perspective, in golf, you need to generate angular momentum in the frontal plane as much as you do in the horizontal plane. In baseball, it's much more about the horizontal plane because of the way the bat moves. And then, you know, you'd have to recognize the differences that in golf, you can take all the time in the world to hit the ball. So you have different limitations for maximizing club head speed in golf. Club head speed, super important in golf. Bat speed, super important in baseball. But in baseball, you don't have all the time in the world to take your swing. You know, you got a different set of constraints around the baseball hitter. But if you're looking at putting, then I wouldn't look at golf. You know, I'd look maybe something closer to like billiards or darts or, you know, lawn bowling to apply principles from those sports to a skill like putting.
What about tennis? I think when I think about using ground forces for hitting, I think about tennis players kind of getting off the ground.
Yeah. You know, tennis, even a little more extreme would be badminton. I use badminton a lot to show how different the principles of using the ground are in something like golf versus badminton. I'll use badminton over tennis because tennis is somewhere in the middle, but still closer to badminton in that the ground becomes less important the lighter the implement is. So if you were trying to generate maximum club head speed with the driver, and let's say your swing was 100 miles an hour, and you had, for your physical abilities, that was a great swing, 100 miles an hour. Well, if we dropped you out of an airplane in a vacuum, that was possible in outer space, and said, hey, how fast can you swing the golf club? And we gave you lots of practice at it. You'd probably only be able to swing it at 60 miles an hour. So your ability to use the ground, add angular momentum into the system, really helps the ability to generate club head speed. With badminton, your racket speed would be virtually unchanged. Most of the fastest racket speeds in badminton, 150 mile an hour plus speeds, can be generated in free fall. So you jump in the air, make a smash, you don't need any angular momentum in the system. So tennis, helpful to have a little bit more, but you don't need a whole lot of ground interaction in tennis to necessarily maximize racket speed.
Okay. So the stack system, I definitely want to talk about. I'm a user, subscriber, and it helped me out a lot. I used it in the off season. Probably should have kept using it through the whole season, but it did help me out a lot. Definitely picked up some speed. The app is a lot of fun, sort of following your progress and your potential distances as they grow. And so to tell TS members that you're getting 20% off the stack system, which is the perfect way to kick off your off-season work. Go to your member locker. Well, not now. Hang here and listen to us. But then grab your code in your member locker and pick up the stack today. So if folks aren't familiar with the stack at its core, what is it? I mean, they see, okay, there's this stick, there's weights. What is it?
Yeah, so there's the biggest difference is the app and the philosophy we take to what I'll call speed training. There are some important differences with the hardware. So the stack system hardware is configurable into 30 different weight options. Most of the other systems out there don't have that level of resolution. And that ties in, that we need that resolution to tie in with our philosophy. On the surface, it might seem similar. Hey, we're swinging something that's heavy and we're swinging something that's light. You know, we call it overspeed and overload training. But when we prescribe, so when you go into a workout, Tom, and we say, hey, load on 105 grams, what we're trying to do is target a specific percentage of your driver's speed. We know how fast you're swinging your driver from the baseline. In every session, we also track a stack weight that is very close to your driver, so we know how your speed's changing. And in every workout, we're adjusting the weights you're swinging to match a certain percentage of your swing speed. And that's for the overspeed training. But we also do overload training. It seems similar when you're in the app. If you're the user, you just go, oh, load on 240 grams. But the research that's gone into that is quite extensive. So you don't just want, when you do overload training, it's not like you can say, well, swing something that's 20% heavier. You should be targeting the load that's applied to the golfer, not the load in the implement. So maybe we've taken 195 grams on the end of the stack system. That equates to very similar loads to your driver. Well, if we say, hey, load an extra 50 grams on there and you get up to 245, that doesn't mean that the load that is experienced by your body is an extra 45, 50 grams. And it's not even a percentage of the weight that's increased. There's a very complex relationship there between the weight you add onto an implement and the loads experienced by the body. What we want to do is have the loads experienced by the body change by, you know, 5, maybe maximum 10%. So I have to go into my lab using the motion capture system you have here, using the force plates that are over to my right, and do systematic research where we have people swing their driver, measure the loads, and then we have them swing various weights to figure out, okay, what are the loads that they are experiencing? And so even right down to, it looks like we're just changing the weights on the end, but what we're actually manipulating is the center mass of the stack, the moment of inertia of the stack, and the overall weight. And that allows us to specifically hit those loads on the body that we want to just target the right amount of stimulus to get the best adaptation for overload training as well as overspeed. So the philosophy is a little more complex. It's very simple and easy to follow from the user standpoint, but there's a lot of research that went into developing the programs that we use.
For sure. Very easy to use. But yeah, as I'm using it, or as anyone who's used it, you're wondering, oh, I wonder why am I swinging today a lighter weight to start than a heavier weight, and your program sort of changes. Where did that science come from? Is it trial and error? Like, do you line up, like, okay, you know, building the daily program?
So it started with some very fundamental research of simply, okay, once we, you know, kind of have an idea of what weights people should swing to get certain loadings and overspeed versus overload, then you say, okay, well, let's put it in practice. Let's run an experiment. What happens if we have a group of people, they just do overload training? How much weight's too much, where they don't start to see continual increases in speed? What about overspeed training? How light can we go? Should we be swinging at 110% of our driver speed? Maybe 112. Does 118 get too fast? Should you do overload and overspeed training in the same week, in the same session? Should you do 3 weeks of overload, then 3 weeks of overspeed? All these questions we addressed, you know, iteratively over about 8 years to come up with some initial programs. Okay, we're pretty sure these are really good guidelines to put in an app that will help people get faster. And sprinkled in there is also some research on, hey, does Tom respond better to a program that is slightly more overspeed or slightly more overload? But since we've launched the app, we can now really, we've ramped up the pace at which we can do research. So in my lab here, I could bring in a group of 30 golfers to do overload, 30 golfers to do overspeed, which would be a lot for a university study, track them, see the progress. Well, today we have 50 new golfers signing up for the stack system. We're going to get entered into a program. Well, we are running experiments. We also have about 200 golfers that have already signed up today to start their second or their third program. Right. They're getting entered into an experiment. So the app is in this infinity loop of progress where we start to say, hey, is 20 seconds, like very specific questions that you would never ask in a typical academic setting because it would take decades and decades to answer all of these questions. Is 20 seconds rest better than 30 seconds rest? Should you do an overspeed set then followed by an overload set? Should you, if you're phasing out a program, if you're doing an 8-week program, how should you change the volume of overspeed and overload throughout the program? So all these questions, now the research and answering them can be accelerated because we've got 30,000 users. And you know, like we track now close to, I think 17 or 18 million swings where we know every single swing, we know the weight the person swung, the speed they swung it, their age, how much rest they've had. Yeah, really, really accelerates the research.
The way to swing the club, or rather the stick, different than the golf, than one swings the golf club, the same, similar, and also in the system, you know, where there are different levels of how you ask the players to swing. So how does one go about physically using it? Should we swing it like a golf club? Is there a different way to use it? What if our swing's pretty lousy? And are we now just getting lousier because we're swinging it poorly and now it's going faster?
Yeah, you won't get lousier. I'll say that. That's probably true. I have a lot to unpack there. So yes, you should, for the most part, swing it like a golf club. You know, at the very simplest level, when you start out in a program, we ask you to swing it at what's called full intent, which is the fastest you would ever swing in a golf course. So I give an example of, imagine you're on a par five, relatively wide open fairway. You know, you need an eagle to force a playoff. You're on 18, you know, with how the group in front of you finished. So however hard you would swing there, you know, you can't swing out of your shoes because if you top it, well, you're not making an eagle. So, you know, but you still want to send it down there pretty far. So the full intent is as much effort as you would ever use in a competitive round of golf. And you spend a lot of the first program, the foundation program, swinging at that level of effort. But then we have you move into what's called max intent, which is, look, we're just trying to absolutely get this club moving as fast as we possibly can. And that's usually where you should have some self-awareness. And I've got lots of FAQs on this, around this topic on the Stack System webpage. But here's a good way to think of it. Every stacker is somewhere on a continuum during their training, and you could move within the continuum within a workout. On one end of the continuum are golfers that should just 100% focus on speed. Just get that radar number cranking out as high a speed as possible. And I'll give you an example of someone that should be at that end of the continuum. A former tour player, he's now on the Champions Tour. His club head speed when he played was 115. It's now down to 95. Hasn't missed a fairway since 2017. Okay. This person needs to focus on 100% effort. Just make the number as fast as possible. That goes for a lot of LPGA players that I work with as well. But then there's lots of people that could fit into that end of the continuum. On this other end of the continuum might be a high handicapper. So this is someone who's you know, certainly trying to work on speed, but they can also make a lot of progress on improving the mechanics of their swing. And you can play with that, you know, that level of the continuum. I think that answered a couple of your questions.
They certainly did. I think when it comes to mechanics, if your numbers are improving, I found, at least this is just from my experience, that, you know, your mechanics are probably probably in a good place. I found myself, okay, as I'm working and going through the exercises, you know, I have a tendency to sort of not use my lower body and not use my any sort of hip turn. And obviously that's going to detract from my speed. So when I was starting to do that more and think about that a little more, my speeds were going up. I mean, good speed probably reveals there's probably decent mechanics there.
100%. That's a very sound principle to follow, is that better mechanics for repeatability are probably going to be associated with higher speed levels. There's, if we look at the physical abilities of a lot of amateurs, they exceed tour players, but those tour players can generate a lot of speed because they have better mechanics. You know, Matt Fitzpatrick, last tournament in Hawaii, his average club head speed was 118.6. But, you know, that's pretty good speed for his physical capabilities because he has good mechanics. You know, so if when his mechanics break down, his speed doesn't jump up. You know, his speed gets slower with his mechanics. So he can certainly look at those speed numbers and say, yeah, if my speed's lower, it's because my mechanics aren't great. And that applies to a lot of us as well.
Yeah. How fast can a human being, you've done all the research, you've got the lab there, how fast can a human being swing the golf club before they poke a hole in the universe?
Well, right now, are we close to, I think, is it a 48-inch driver? Seb Waddell, is that the chap's name, is pretty close to 170 miles an hour. So, I mean, I don't know. The sport is relatively new. I guess I would say that within the next 10 years, might not be crazy to think someone's close to 175, 176. But, you know, all human performance continues to improve. There's no reason to think it will ever stop. Seems realistic to think that it will improve at a slower rate. But yeah, there's always, no matter what state you can imagine, someone swinging at 176, you could look at it and say, well, if they just had a little bit more fast twitch, if, you know, they had just this little bit better coordination, if we could make the club just a little bit lighter, we'd see an improvement. So it will continue to get faster forever, just like every other skill we do as humans. There's a lot of wiggle room in the PGA Tour for club head speed, though, that's for sure.
Yeah, there's a pretty wide range out there for sure. And we've been hearing a lot about that when we're talking about the golf ball and the rollback, which I want to talk about. First, I want to ask you, though, if someone's trying to pick up speed, they're using the stack system in their off days or in their other days, they're also exercising and working out. How to pinpoint, you know, what are the muscles or muscle groups or exercises or things that you suggest people might be doing to sort of augment their speed journey?
Yeah, I really like Mike Carroll, Fit for Golf. I don't know how many folks on here have followed him, but I'm 99.99% aligned with his philosophies, and he puts a lot of excellent exercises out there. You know, it depends. If you sit at a desk, if you're fair, big, strong guy, sit at a desk all the time, probably some mobility work, you know, opening up your hips, opening up your shoulders, not necessarily just static stretching, but range of motion movements could be very helpful. If you can't, you know, squat your own body weight and can't do a pull-up, then probably you're better off doing some strength training exercises. I think that you want to do if you're not doing exercises where you can measure or see an improvement, or at least in how you feel, if you don't feel like you're getting more flexible, then probably don't, those probably aren't worth it. Those are very generalized comments. I think the exercises that I would recommend to someone very much depend on the state they're in. A lot of the mini tour guys that I work with, young guys have very little, if we're talking about clubhead speed, have very low, they're not going to gain a whole lot from getting a lot stronger. If you can do, 10 pull-ups and you can deadlift 350 pounds, a lot of these young kids can, then you're not going to see much gains in terms of increase in clubhead speed from putting a lot more time in the gym necessarily. Probably you're going to see most of your gains from doing some training with something like the stack system.
Now where do you think the average golfer, where do you think they most lose speed?
A couple of buckets. I was to guess with the folks on here looking at some of the
all scratch players, Sasha.
Okay, awesome.
You have to be in the Broken Tee Society. I forgot to mention.
Oh, no kidding. Okay, perfect. That's very helpful.
No, I am.
You are kidding. I was like, this sounds really exclusive. Immediately, I thought, how are you? Everybody has to submit scorecards and you get booted out.
Exactly.
There's a couple of big buckets. There's obviously mechanics. I think that's where probably most people's brains go towards. So if you start training with the stack system, hopefully there's some organic changes in your swing mechanics that improve clubhead speed just by, taking a swing, you look at the radar number, and the next swing you take, you happen to lift your lead heel, or you think about, I'm going to get my hand path a little longer, or you think about a faster backswing. So that self-exploration can lead to some natural changes. I don't want to use the word natural, but some, kind of organic, non-conscious integrations of swing mechanic changes into your golf swing. That's a big one. Sure, but an equally large one is people just realizing that they can swing faster. There's a lot of folks that have, over time, they don't practice a whole lot. So they go out, maybe they hit a few balls in the range at best, and they go to the first tee and they play. And they've over time worked themselves into a very constrained swing, especially folks that are, 45 to 75. They get very safe out there, and they don't realize that with a little bit of practice, you don't have to worry about increasing your dispersion if you're bringing more clubhead speed to the tee. I got a lot more thoughts on that, but those are two kind of big buckets. You change your mechanics and you just learn how to actually, it's okay to use a little bit more effort.
Yeah, I think that's something you hear from a lot of people that might be reluctant to get into speed training is that my ball is going right, my ball is going left. I don't want it to get there faster, to hit it farther offline. If I'm on a first tee or in a big event, I don't want to be ripping at it like a beast, but can you speak to the impact that, trying to get your maximum capacity up actually has on say your game swing?
Yeah. So first of all, I'll say that probably doesn't apply to everybody. Some people might already be swinging at a very high percentage. Those folks, I do not want them swinging any faster. There's just a bucket of folks that are playing golf at like 80% of their maximum, and going up to 90 is definitely not going to have a negative impact, especially with a bit of speed training. But overall, the philosophy with the stack system that we use is it's to increase your maximum clubhead speed potential, so you can actually play golf at a lower percentage but that lower percentage is faster than your current clubhead speed. So I've got an example here. Let's say that your current maximum clubhead speed, you're super warmed up, it's 95 degrees, lovely day in Orlando, and the fastest you can swing the club is 100 miles an hour. But you're playing at 95. Okay, that's how fast you swing the club on the first tee. You're at 95% of your maximum. Engage in some stack training. You improve your maximum swing speed from 100 to 110 over 8 weeks. But now you're playing golf at 100 miles an hour. That's what you tee off. You're not teeing off at 95 anymore. You've increased by 5 miles an hour. You're playing at 100, but 100 as a percentage of 110 is only 90. You're actually playing at a lower percentage of your maximum effort. I would fully expect, given those percentages, that you'll be a little bit more repeatable. And this is what Fitzpatrick did initially. He made some, 3 years ago now, but made some nice gains in his maximum clubhead speed potential, but only increased his on-course speed by a couple miles per hour. And his dispersion actually decreased. Ball was going further, dispersion was less. And this is using his own statistics that Eduardo Molinari collects. So he knows where his target is and where the ball landed relative to his own target. So that was pretty cool to see clubhead speed go up by a couple of miles an hour, dispersion decrease. Ball's going further, dispersion tighter. But that was because he was swinging at a lower percentage of his maximum. And as he continued to increases clubhead speed, we started to actually have him swing absolutely faster relative to the world, but actually increase his percentage as well to more optimize his strokes gained off the tee. So there's a certain balance between, okay, well, I could gain 5 more yards, but I'll hit a few more balls offline. There's a balance between those that will optimize your strokes gained. Initially, you're probably not optimizing your strokes gained if you're hitting it further and straighter. It sounds right, but you could probably actually swing even faster. So we found a sweet spot there in the summer of 2021, 2022.
Well, you certainly did. So good to know. Just because I'm sweating and grunting and coming out of my shoes in my garage, it's not necessarily what I'm going to be doing on the golf course. But yeah, your gamer swing, just picking up even a little bit of speed, a big advantage there.
Yeah, if you look, I'll say one more example, if you don't mind, because it's an excellent one. I know there's a lot of people out there that are worried about chasing speed. I get this, every once in a while from a tour player, hey, I might want to do some stack training, but I'm worried I'm going to lose my swing or we're just going to go crazy. Like him or hate him, Bryson DeChambeau is an awesome example of this. When he was on the PGA Tour, he decided, I'm going to get faster. Now, he did a lot of things. I'll save that conversation for another time unless people, want me to answer some questions about it. But bottom line is he greatly increased his maximum ball speed potential. So I think, when he was last on the PGA Tour, his ball speed average was around, low 190s. Let's for easy math, let's say 190. I don't know if there's any fact checkers on here, but if someone, let's say low 190s, 190, just for easy math. And at that time, everybody was kind of like, huh, wow. And now he's at the top of the strokes gained off the tee performance. So really good drivers of the golf ball, like Rory, are like, yeah, maybe I'll go chase this speed idea. And in that is the thought that I need to now swing with more effort on the course. So Rory's ball speed, let's say, is 185, 186. Yeah, I'm just going to ramp this up to the low 190s. I'm going to start swinging at 190. But what they don't realize is that Bryson's maximum ball speed is closer to 210. When he was doing the world long drive competition shortly after the Ryder Cup, he was hitting ball speeds 218, 219. Now, granted, with world long drive competition stuff. So let's be really conservative and say it's 210. Well, if he's playing with a ball speed of 190, that's only 90% of 210. Whereas Rory trying to play at a ball speed of 190, tees up at a much higher level. So it looks like at, you know, 190 ball speed, oh, that's crazy. How is he hitting it on the planet? Well, it's not a very high percentage of his maximum effort. So he can do that. It might look wild, but it's relatively controlled for him. So that concept of playing at a percentage of your maximum effort and training to improve your maximum abilities is really important.
So you mentioned Matt Fitzpatrick a few times, and your work with him was, you know, what a year he had that year, and well documented his increase, his hard work on picking up speed. And also very well known as a very studious and, you know, tracking his shots. And, you know, was he sort of the ideal pupil?
Yeah, absolutely was. I don't have a lot of time. I do a lot of things. I enjoy working with players, but I don't have a lot of time to add new players. I like going to the odd event, but I don't like being on tour that much. I've got a family anyway. So it was a very nice opportunity. It was during COVID. It was a real hassle to actually go and work with him. I had to like isolate in a cabin in the middle of nowhere in Nova Scotia for 2 weeks after I went down to visit him. But I did that because absolutely. He was the perfect person to work with. He's really determined, amazing work ethic, follows science, attention to detail. I got really lucky.
Are there any shots that you recall from the Open at Brookline where you think, that shot, he might not have been able to pull that shot off other, you know, before the speed training, and what did that feel like?
Every drive. I mean, he was, every drive, he was driving to pass DJ, earlier in the week. And then, you know, Will Zalatoris is not short, but he was driving to pass Will all day, but there was the drivable par four. No one drove it. Alt had driven the green all Sunday. It's cold, you know, you're in contention and you hit 181 ball speed and you're the only person to drive the green and have an eagle putt. You know, that's, you know, when I started working with him and his coach, Mike Walker, reached out and they said, look, the next step is to start winning majors. And we just finished playing with Dustin Johnson at Augusta. DJ on hole 11's got an 8-iron in and, you know, we're hitting a 4-iron. Into hole 11, that wears you out four rounds at Augusta, you know, and not, most of the other tournaments are the same. The PGA plays long, US Open plays long. So it's like, your odds on being able to break through and win majors, if you're not hitting the ball far, it just puts way too much pressure in other parts of your game. You know, it's possible, but you really want to be hitting the ball further. And yeah, so it was a small improvement to, you know, the overall picture of how awesome his game is, but it was kind of what made the glass kind of spill over, I think.
So you talked a little bit about, I want to tie that to the rollback. You talked a little bit about, that over time, you know, speeds are just because of the way the trajectory of sports and athletics, speeds will continue to go up. And in response to that, the USJ and RNA have come up with their change in testing standards. What are your thoughts on the rollback? Is it your fault? You probably get people asking you that.
Probably a little bit. I mean, I've, you know, the long list of tour players that are using the stack, and I can, you know, see how speed has increased. So it's certainly moved the average up. There's no doubt about that. I don't think there's not a well-defined problem. I've got no problem with a rollback per se. It just bothers me when you're not defining a problem. Hey, this is the issue we're going to try to solve, and this is why we think what we're doing will solve this issue. just really bad science, the way they're approaching it. It's just disappointing from that level. I don't think it's going to have the intended effect. But the main reason being is people, there's a couple of issues, I guess. So we look at driving distance. We go, okay, yeah, we don't want people to hit the ball any further. And we think that that's a function of club head speed. I say we, let's just say the USGA and the RNA, I'm assuming this is their logic. Well, if we slow the ball down, club head speeds are going to stay the same. So therefore, the ball will go shorter. But that's missing the reality of what's happening. Golfers are becoming more optimized in terms of maximizing strokes gained. That's why we see golfers, you know, hitting certain clubs off of tees. Why are more people going for, you know, the green at Riviera? Why are more people, you know, less people laying up? You know, so the driving distances in those holes has gotten huge. If you like looked at it over time, if you're just looking at the data and you go, wow, look at how much the driving distance on this drivable par four has increased. That's not a function of people getting faster. That's a function of strategy. People realizing that this is the best way to maximize strokes gained. So if you slow the ball down, golfers are still going to try to maximize their strokes gained. So someone like, let's say, Tony Finau, who's swinging faster at the start of this year, but he has the ability to swing at 140 miles an hour. He would never probably bring that on the course, but he might bring 126, 127. That's well within a percentage that he could, you know, still hit the fairway, but he's playing at 120. You slow the ball down for him, and he looks at it, you know, the majority of par fours he's playing, and you slow the ball down, the ball's going to be in the fairway. So then he says, okay, I want to optimize my strokes gain. Instead of swinging at 120, hey, I'll just hit this slower ball at 124. And now I'm back to re-optimizing for my strokes gained. And then there'll be players who won't be able to do that overnight. There'll be players that have done what Fitzpatrick has done, say, hey, I'm going to really get at some speed training. Someone like, you know, Dustin Johnson, whose ball speed has stayed, you know, over the course of his career, very constant around, you know, 180, maybe a little bit lower than that. If all of a sudden, when DJ was in his 20s, if you said, hey, play the slower ball, he would have done some more intense training and jumped up his club head speed so that his ball speed jumped back up to, you know, 178, 180 to optimize his strokes gain. And then you'd have players that wouldn't be able to adapt, you know, that wouldn't do the training. Those players will slowly get replaced by the kids coming out of college who maybe aren't as great short game players or putters, but now there's this increased emphasis on reward for being able to hit the ball further. So that if you really wanted to have an effect, going along with that is understanding that we're currently at a very low percentage of what club head speed could be. So right now, the PGA Tour average is 115-ish. That's what it was last year. That's not fast, right? Fast is 170. That's what the maximum is that people can generate right now. There's a lot of room between 115 and 170. I'm not saying the average is going to get to 140. There'll be people making swings at 140, the odd swing on the PGA Tour. But is it that hard to fathom that the top 150 golfers in the world can't move the average club head speed from 115 to, say, 120, 125? Knowing that everybody on here has played with someone in the last 6 months who swings at 120, 125. You know, these are the best 150 athletes in the world. Let's compare it to baseball. Does anybody play, you know, local pickup baseball with someone who can throw 100 mile an hour fastball? No, they don't. So there's a lot of room to have that average club head speed tick up. So I think slowing the ball down a little bit, we'll just be right back to where we are now. And then we'll have to, you know, very quickly, we'll have to slow the ball down again. The more we slow the ball down, you know, there's that comes back to the ill-defined nature of the problem. You know, it's like, well, what problem are we solving? People like, well, I like shot, people that are for the rollback say, well, I like shot shaping. I want to see these finesse players. If you slow the ball down enough, you're just going to have bombers out there. Those are the only people that are going to be able to really compete, right? It's 10 years ago, David Toms, or maybe longer than that, 15 years ago, David Toms at 104 and 105 was, you know, kind of competing out there. There's no more 104, 105 players. As the average moves up, the bottom has to move with it. That's a lot of thoughts. I don't even know if I'm still connected to this.
Those are good thoughts, though. Yeah, no. Very, very interesting thoughts, though, Sasha. Gosh, we could talk about this more. Do you think there's a better approach to this issue of distance and courses becoming obsolete versus instead of the ball?
Yeah. Okay. So here's the problem is that, Mike Wong come on and said, hey, I got this folder of courses that we can't play currently because they're too short. Well, we're going to roll back the ball and all those courses are still staying in that folder. So that's confusing. What you need to do instead of this abstract pie in the sky feeling stuff, show me a hole. Find a course, find 10 holes that are like, hey, these are the problem holes. These are the holes that they're not being played the way we want. And go get a slow ball and say, hey, let's give Rory a week with this slow ball. Let's see how he eventually figures out how to play it. Or Tony Finau or someone. Does this solve the problem? And, you know, maybe it doesn't. There's already clues around course design. You can go through ShotLink and you can say, look at all the average clubhead speeds on par fours. And you can go, huh, this is a long par four. Why is the average clubhead speed so low? You know, why is the average clubhead speed in this hole really high? You know, you look at an overhead view and you're like, why are these long bombers not cutting the corner on this dogleg left in this hole? And then you look at the hole design from actually on the tee box. And you look just a little bit to the left and you see a very inconspicuous 20-foot pine tree, not ruining the hole at all. No one sees it. They look down the fairway. The only person that sees that 20-foot pine tree is Bryson, who's trying to take this crazy line. So he looks and he goes, I can't get my ball over that. You know, as an example, because we can all picture the hole, Bay Hill, you know, if you didn't want someone taking the, I'm not saying I'm for this. I thought, you know, Bryson going for the greenish and that hole was awesome. But if you're like, hey, I don't like that, you want people to look more down the fairway, you know, out of sight, doesn't have to be super close, you know, 20, 30 feet away, put a pine tree. Now you go, okay, that line's no longer there, but it does nothing to the aesthetic of the course. You put some features, some course design features. That's the first way that I would approach it. That seems like, hey, we think this course on the PGA Tour rotation next year is going to be played not the way we want. You know, we're going to have to increase the length of these tees. Well, maybe let's do an experiment. Instead of increasing the length of the tees, what if we had the rough pinch in at 330 yards? You know, what if we added a gorse bush here? What if we put a tree here? Just make some subtle design changes that aren't particularly expensive. Do an experiment like that. Do an experiment where you slow the ball down and have, you know, some people play a hole and see what happens. Just don't, like, it just seems like lazy science to just say, hey, we're not really going to do much testing with this new ball. And we don't really know what the problem is, but let's do it and see what happens. I don't know. Hey, ball rollback solves a problem. Okay, whatever. I just don't like the way they're approaching. It doesn't seem optimal.
Approaching it as a scientist, which would only be appropriate. Sasha, I can't thank you enough for your time. I can't let you go, though, without getting to a couple questions from our guests. That's okay. Or rather, our audience.
I got another half an hour, so I'm here.
Well, there we go. How about what's going on with stack putting? That seems, how does Yeah. Stack. How do we align what we're doing in terms of swing speed with our putting?
Yeah, stack putting might be better than stack speed training. Basically, I thought it was the lowest hanging fruit. A lot of the stuff that I'm doing is around, helping my own game and helping the players that I work with. With the stack system, it was a spreadsheet with, people like Fitzpatrick, and I'm like, hey, this would be way, easier if it was in an app. There's some motivation there. But when I'm, designing putting practice sessions, it's like, wow, this would be, a lot better if I put this into an app. So I think stack putting is both the if you're going to put any time into your putting to practice it, then stack putting is the best way to practice your putting. If you've got 20 minutes once or twice a week, it's going to get you the most bang for your buck for the vast majority of golfers out there for putting, and it's going to give you the most insights. Definitely. It's free for all, everybody that gets a stack. Give it a go. There's so many features. Have you tried it, Tom?
I haven't tried it, so I'm really curious just a little bit how it works.
Yeah, so there's three modes. The best mode is called Premier, and you hop in. You need a green to do Premier mode. You need a green that has at least a 30-foot putt and a bit of slope. And the app basically sets up 18 holes for you and systematically walks you through them. So it's like, hey, hole one, 6 feet uphill left to right. So you look around the practice screen. There could be other golfers out there. It doesn't matter. You find a hole that's got a 6 foot uphill right to left putt. You've got this really slick interface that allows you to say why you've missed the putt. A couple of taps. It's real easy. Did you hit it too fast? Did you hit it too far left? So a misread feature. We keep track of your strokes gained putting for that hole as you go along. And we've got strokes gained for everybody from a plus five handicap to a 30 handicap. So your strokes gained is relative to your ability. Runs you through 18 holes. Tells you if you've got any speed bias. Are you hitting putts too fast or too slow? If you've got any direction bias. And it accumulates your stats over time. So you can track your performance. You can try to adjust your biases. There's plots that will tell you and insights that'll say, hey, you know what? You seem to miss all your left to right putts on the high side. And it's very clear in the interface that's an issue you need to address. We also have this really cool feature that's called statistical comparison. And it came about, for my own needs, but also, I don't know if folks on here remember Xander Schauffele a couple of years ago switching to that arm lock grip. Everybody was all, lots of golfers like, it should be illegal. It's awesome. It's too easy. Well, why isn't everybody doing it? So he switched. He was, I think, 19th in strokes gained putting, switched, plummeted, and then switched back to his regular grip. And, he was saying, well, I tested it out. I was like, did you really test it out? So in all the modes of stack putting, you can tag whether what technique you're using, what putter you're using. And let's say you wanted to test out a different way you were holding the putter. You go in one session, tag the grip you're using. Next session, you use a different grip. And then after you've, done four or five sessions, might take a week. Maybe you've been doing it all summer, trying different putters, whatever. You can do the comparison at different points in time. You hit statistical comparison. It runs a legitimate, I teach quantitative research methods at university. It runs a legitimate statistical analysis to tell you which technique, which putter, whatever factor you want to investigate in your putting is better. We've got an on-course mode. You can do all the stuff in Premier mode, but on the course. We've got aim point features built in, so you can enter the grade of the slope of the putt you're hitting it on. And then we've also got a creative combines mode where you can create any practice session you want for putting. So I've got a little indoor putting green over here. It's it's only 22 feet long, 10 feet wide, and it's at a constant slope right now. But I can, for that green, go in and set up a practice session that I want that works for me. I can send that to any of the players in my stable. It could be a friend I'm competing with, could be a student that I'm working with, and they can complete that combine and track all these cool stats.
Very cool. That's in the app that I have?
That's in the app that you have. It's an app within an app. And we have launching any day now. We're hoping to have it up for the PGA show. It's going to be another tab at the bottom called Learning Library. And I've filmed about 70 videos that we've got. I've come up with the system where we've got concepts, swing moves and feels and drills. And we've got different videos covering, you know, ground reaction forces, swing mechanics. So yeah, all these videos for tips and things you can do to incorporate into your stack training and into your driver swing. It's a really cool little interactive library where you can do different searches and stuff and find these. You know, some videos are 30 seconds. Some of the concept videos get up around 2 minutes, but it's basically all these really cool thoughts that might help you while you're doing your stack training.
We have some questions from folks on the timing of their workouts. How much is too long to wait between them? If you haven't been able to do it and you see diminishing returns, you know, how much is too soon? I mean, there's guidance on the app when to come back, but, and also what time of day is best, you know, to be doing your training.
Sure. So, here's some general guidelines. So first, the app gives you a window, and it's an hour. So as we optimize, we have 30,000 golfers doing all this training. We start to quickly figure out what's too much time, what's not enough time. So instead of having it in days, it's down to hours. Sometimes that the range that pops up in the app looks weird. It's like, you know, like after you finish your workout, it's like train before or after 7 a.m. on the 19th, but before, you know, 11 p.m. on the, you know, but it's like, weird.
I'm booked.
Yeah. But that you doesn't have to, you don't have to train at those weird times because we have people that are different time zones all over the world. They're traveling. So it might look funny, but it doesn't look funny. It might look funny to you, but it doesn't look funny to them necessarily. We do have it to your specific time zone, but we don't know where you're traveling anyway, or maybe you have shift work. So some people are like, I don't want to train at 4 a.m. Yeah. But maybe the, you know, the emergency doctor down the street from you does. Any time in that window is fine. The vast majority of people, so we can look at all this data, swing fastest in the late afternoon, early evening. Early mornings for the majority of people are not great. You certainly want to be training at a point of time in the day where you're swinging the fastest. So you might feel freshest in the morning, but if your speeds tend to be slower, that means you're not going to be getting the most out of your workout. So you could be mentally tired or even tired, like from a feeling of like, oh, I've, you know, just finished walking the course, you know, so maybe you've played 18 holes. So your legs feel tired, but your swing speed might actually be pretty fast. You might be better off training after 18 holes than if you tee off at, you know, 7 a.m. and trying to do your stack workout at 6. That might be less optimal than training after you play 18 holes. So when you swing the fastest is the best time to train. You relative to other physical activities, if you're doing intense workouts that are fatiguing, that will result in you swinging slower, then stack before that. So if you've got like a leg day where you do like 6 sets of squats and, you know, 5 sets of deadlifts, and then you go to the leg press machine and you do some lunges, you know, do your stack workout before that. If you do yoga, if that's your workout and you do a half an hour of stretching and mobility work, hey, that's probably a good thing to do before you stack. If you go for a 15-mile run, probably should do that after you do your stack training. I also, it's good to time your stacks. You know, if you have a really intense weight workout, for example, or a really long run, better to do it on the day of the run or on the day of the hard workout before it than the next day. Because a lot of times we're in a state of recovery the next day, and that will be even more impactful for our ability to generate high clubhead speeds. happy to answer further questions around
great advice. Or,
oh, I'll say this. This is really important. You, not everybody can stick to the program. You know, things happen. So we can see, hey, what happens to these folks that are seemingly doing a really good job of sticking to the training when they do it, but the gaps are like 5 days or 6 days. Really bad idea. If you did an awesome stack workout, this is a common occurrence with green grass accounts where like, I want to bring my, you know, my clients in every Monday over the winter, and we'll do a stack session. With a college coach, it's like, hey, we're going to bring the gals in, you know, every Tuesday morning, that's when we're going to do our speed train, but we're going to do it, you know, for like 6 months. If you did an awesome stack session, you were super warmed up, hyped up, music blaring, ready to go, great workout every Monday for a year, 52 awesome workouts every Monday, I would expect you to gain no miles per hour, zero. You've just wasted every Monday. The frequency of those workouts is really important. If there's anybody on here that's ever lifted weights, it's usually a little bit longer for lifting weights, but let's say everybody will know if you do a really hard bench press workout and you wait 8 or 9 days, well, you've recovered from that workout, potentially seen some gains, but then you're right back to where you started. So all that's going to happen is you're just going to be really sore with a couple of days to follow. You're not going to make any overall progress, and you're going to increase your risk of injury. And it's going to be very, mentally draining to be like, I'm putting in this effort. Why am I not getting faster? So you don't need to go every second day, right? You don't need to go Monday, Wednesday, Friday, unless you're feeling really good. But don't let those times between sessions get 5, 6, 7 days. Really, really avoid that.
All right, folks, stick to it, would you?
Yeah.
I am one of the fallen. I've dropped off and need to pick it back up. Actually, so for those of us who have, say, okay, we were winter stackers, winter's back, I want to get back into it, I guess we just kind of start from the beginning.
Yeah, that's the life that I live. I'm in Canada right now. It's very cold. There's no golf in the summer. The three kids are all playing golf, soccer, doing different things. You know, I'd like to stack more. I'll do speed priming sessions, but I just don't, middle of July to the end of August and in September, I don't do any stacking. I treat it. It's something that I'll do for the rest of my life, though, is I'll lose a little bit of speed over the end of the summer. But hey, I've got 6 months here to make some hay, and I'll get my speed back up to hopefully, at the start of the spring, I'll be playing closer to like 114, 115. Might drop down to 110 by the end of the summer. And then, when I'm maybe the kids are out of the house and all I'm doing is golfing in the summer, if I'm retired, then, hey, you can train for the most part all year round. But there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I've taken some time off. But when you do get back into training, for those off-season months, that's when you want to keep your make sure your frequency is not getting too far between those workouts. It's okay to be cyclical in your fitness.
Would it be best for someone to go back to the sort of foundation program?
Yeah, it depends on how much time you're taking off. That's what I like to do. So I did I just finished the foundation program, and I'm gonna the app recommended a trail arm enhancer for the first time. I've been doing the stack system for 3 years. I've got a pretty big difference between my lead and trail arm. My trail arm tends to get slower. And I've taken there's a lot of effort that's gone into programming a lot of decisions into the recommendations, the programming that decides what the workout should be that day. I'm just a regular stacker. Like I see the workout come up on my phone and I'm like, huh, I guess that makes sense. I just, whatever the app recommends for a program, I select it. Like, so I'll have people say, hey, take a look at my data. What program would you recommend? I spent, hundreds of hours programming this app to make better decisions than me. It's all the same. It's all my philosophies. The app just doesn't make mistakes and it's able to take in all this information that would take me an hour to sit down and try to sort through. The app does that very eloquently for us.
The app
does it? What does it do for folks who are asking about if they're coming back from an injury or doing PT? How can, you know, swinging a weighted implement, how can that be useful?
Yeah, certainly that's very specific to what you're rehabbing from. If your orthopedic surgeon, if your PT has said, yeah, you can play golf, then these guidelines are important. If you can hit 40 balls, you know, a normal bucket of golf balls, and feel okay the next day, or if you can go out and play 9 holes of golf and feel okay the next day, then you are fine to start stacking, do a foundation program. You need to warm up early. So there's a 15-minute warm-up in the app. You need to be sweating before you do speed training. So follow the warm-up guide in the app. But the reality, Tom, is that I get way more questions, like the question you just asked me. We got 30,000 users. Every week I get a question saying, I hurt myself playing golf. Or I hurt myself doing something else, but usually it's playing golf. I need to take a break from stacking. How do I get back into it? You know, very, very rarely does somebody associate an injury with their stacking, considering that we've had, you know, 30,000 users and, you know, millions and millions of swings. The likelihood of injuring yourself, the act of taking divots, you know, slamming a club really hard into the ground and taking a chunk of dirt or into a mat, the forces in the body are much higher than when we can gradually dissipate them during a follow through. So those are the guidelines. Bucket of balls. Can you play 9 holes? Make sure that you've been cleared to play golf by your PT or your orthopedic surgeon. And we have, if you do find that maybe, I've been playing golf a lot. I've been practicing, squeezing in some stack workouts. I feel like a little bit of tendonitis is coming on. I feel like the heavy weights, maybe you got some arthritis in your hands. A lot of times the lighter weights, maybe if you have arthritis, the grip wants to pull out of your bottom hand through impact forwards. Some users have said they've gotten a little knuckle pain. We have the option to do a flex program. And the flex program allows you to decide every workout you go in. You're like, hey, okay, I'm going to do a workout today. 9 options for that day's workout pop up. You can do low volume, an 8-minute workout, medium, 15-minute workout, or a high volume, 25-minute workout, depending on how you feel. And you can choose over speed only, a mix, or overload only. And some people think overload is probably going to be harder for most people. A lot of people find the over speed, moving their body at high speeds, that can be a little more taxing. So depending on how you feel, you can choose one of those 9 workouts. That gives people rehabbing, or if they're, you know, trying to nurse through an injury, a little bit more flexibility to ease themselves into speed training.
Okay. Well, you know, when I started doing this, one of my reservations was that, like, at least the swings that I admired and wanted to copy or just think look like, you know, as opposed to, say, Bryson swinging very hard at the ball was not sort of aesthetically pleasing or beautiful or anything that I wanted to imitate. You know, I want to swing like Sam Snead. I want to swing like Ben Hogan, Bobby Jones, Fred Couples, that sort of oily swing. But they're probably swinging pretty fast. I mean, how do you...
Yeah.
Is there anything, you know, by increasing speed, is there any risk of, for us purists out there, becoming bombers instead of, you know, sweet slingers?
Well, I'll tell you what, the best path to being able to swing like Freddie Couples and still have his clubhead speed is through speed training. If, you know, think about how many different ways, Martin Borgmeyer could look silky smooth at 115 miles an hour. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah. Well, yeah, Chris Kirk. I mean,
yeah, right. He exactly. you also have to realize, you know, there's that side of it. If you really do want to look silky smooth, you better have the capability to swing crazy fast with full effort. Because looking silky smooth with an 80 mile an hour clubhead speed, that's not going to be fun. I don't care how much fun you get from looking silky smooth, yeah. Right? It's great to look silky smooth when it's really fast, like Ernie Els or Freddie Couples. DJ Swing looks smooth, but that guy is going after it. And then there's some modern day guys that I think have, you perceive that their effort's low. Like I would say a Max Homa is someone who looks very, you know, mm-hmm. controlled. His facial muscles aren't tensing up, but that guy's going after it. You know, he just looks silky smooth. But then you have guys like Victor Hovland's out there at 98% max effort with his driver. You know, like his ball speed's in the high 170s. I would be shocked if he could hit 185 ball speed. I'm very sure he could not. I mean, so he's playing at a crazy high percentage of his maximum. Scottie Scheffler, the strokes gained beat a green machine last year. He's pretty far from silky smooth. You know, that guy, it looks like on most tee shots, he looks how I want. He's my go-to guy when someone's, you know, struggling to make progress with the stack. We have about 0.5% of our users gain less than 3 miles per hour. And so I those are the folks that I really like to help. And I'll look at their swing and I know they're not a training swing. And I'm like, we got to ramp up the effort level here. And I'll be like, look at you with the stack. No worry about where the ball's going to go. And now let's look at Scottie Scheffler trying to win a major on hole 18. He looks like he's got 10 times more effort than you do. You've got no ball to hit. You got nothing to worry about. He's falling all over the place. You know, that there. So I don't know. I'd take Scottie Scheffler's having a lot of fun playing golf. I think.
Yeah, he certainly is. Yeah. He's fun to watch. But it's, you know, it's that sneaky speed, I guess, really. When you look at some of those former players, it looked effortless. Or even current players that look effortless.
Yeah.
The clubhead's still really moving.
Yeah.
So it can be deceptive. Sasha, I can't thank you enough. Can you tell us what's the next frontier for the stack? You've got all this data now, 17 million swings, I think it was.
Yeah.
Where is this thing? Where's all this going?
We've got so many projects and directions. So there's the learning library where I want folks to be able to go in, have some thoughts about what they can work on in their swing. And we're going to, you know, start to play those in the set breaks. You got 3 minutes there. So we're going to, you know, do our best to try and figure out, make some recommendations. If you're swinging, you know, relatively fast with the heavyweights, but relatively slower with the lightweights, there are some of those swing tip videos, concepts, feels, thoughts that are more applicable to you. So we'll try to target those. We have related to that two features that I'm excited to work on that are eventually going to come together. We want people to be able to record their own swing. So the general idea is that during a set, you know, you've just finished a set, you got 3 minutes, be able to tap a few buttons, set your phone up to record your swing for a swing in the stack set. That gets uploaded, so now it's kind of saved in posterity. So it's like, this is how I was swinging on that day. So you'll be able to, you know, when you, all the data is saved in the app, so you can go back and look through every workout session, but you'll be able to identify which ones have swings saved with them. But there's, I don't know how long this is going to take, but it's a, you know, pipe dream. We're chipping away at it. Is I can, you know, very quickly for the vast majority of users, look at a swing and recommend what tip videos I would like to give them, right? Okay, this person's casting, this person's staying on their back foot, this person doesn't have a great transition sequence. These are the four videos that they should watch. I during my PhD thesis, I was really big into AI programming. I wrote my own genetic algorithm to the optimization of a forward dynamics model. I'd like to incorporate some machine learning into this. So the idea is to be able to extract some quantitative data. There's lots of solutions out there now from the user swing. So they swing the stack, you upload the video. You know, everybody's seen the markerless technology. So we extract some of that data and then have the app watch me. First, there's going to be stages. So they're going to watch what videos I recommend. So then the app will be able to, the AI in the app will be able to associate the parameters, swing parameters that I pulled from that video with the tip video selections that I make. Right? That'll be phase one training. Phase two, I will go in, start this process, but the app will make the guesses. Then I will approve them or correct them. This will refine the machine learning algorithms. And then eventually, hopefully, we get to a point where I'm watching, but I don't have to make any corrections. So this AI will be essentially behaving exactly like I would. So if I looked at Tom Swing and I think, he's not doing a great job of using the trail leg and, to generate angular momentum, like I think he should. Here are some videos. I let the AI go. Hey, those are the exact videos I would have picked. Great. So that's one feature that we'd like to incorporate along with being able to upload your videos. But there's a million things.
Wow.
Yeah, we got in the pipeline. Being able to set up speed competitions where when you go in, instead of just saying, hey, let's see who gains the most speed, there'll be like sliders so you can set weightings for, let's say Tom and I, we're going to have a competition. How much emphasis do we want to put on how much speed we gain? How much emphasis do we want to put on our starting speed? So it's not really fair if, Tom, you're already swinging at 125 miles an hour and I'm starting at 80, right? You should have some... value added from the fact that you're already swinging fast. And then grit score, how much emphasis do we want to put on how closely we adhere to the program? So that allows, groups of people or individuals to compete in a more fair way instead of who can gain the most speed. Then people could cherry pick and start out slower. But lots of ideas coming with the stack
system. Fantastic. It's like handicapping a match. So that you can compete for speed. And that's fascinating. That should be that'll have to be another podcast. The impact AI is going to have on golf teaching. Fascinating stuff. Sasha, this has been brilliant. Just want to remind everyone, all our Broken Tee Society members, you can go to your member locker and get 20% off the stack system. I'm a user. I know pretty much everyone in the audience probably is as well. So again, thanks so much for your time, and thanks for the speed.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And if you enjoyed this episode, we strongly encourage you to become a member of the Golfer's Journal, or if you already are, to share it with your friends. As a reader-supported publication, we couldn't do it without you. We also couldn't do it without the help of our partners, and they are Titleist, Scotty Cameron, FootJoy, Linksoul, Omega, Charles Schwab, and BMW. We'll see you next time on the Golfer's Journal podcast.